My name is Mike Richards, and I'm an alcoholic. First off, I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come. That was a year ago, and I'm glad this day is finally here. And I want to thank the people who spoke before me. Nancy, who I met this weekend, thanks very much. Philip, Jan, I've known them for a long time. They're a pretty vital part of my recovery, so it was great to be here with them. As a result of coming into this program and getting a sponsor and working the steps and establishing a relationship with a God of my understanding, I haven't found it necessary to drink alcohol since December the 10th of 1997. And I have an app on my phone. That's 8,551 days without a drink. And I don't know about y'all, but that's pretty amazing for an alcoholic like me. But the directions, as I understand them, I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. At this stage, I understand it's important for me to let you know how this all began, I guess. And I grew up in a little bitty small town right outside of Chattanooga, Tennessee, called Signal Mountain, Tennessee. And when I was there, there were 3,200 people on the mountain. I looked it up this morning, and as of 2019, there's 8,500 people there today. And I moved to Birmingham when I was 11 years old, it's pretty a culture shock, and I'm not sure I've recovered from it yet, and that was 50 years ago. My home group, I have two home groups. One of them is the Early Risers group. We meet on Saturday mornings at 8 o'clock at Canterbury United Methodist Church. And my other home group is the New Hope group, and we meet on Monday and Friday at 7 and Saturday at 6:30. And I've been going to those groups a long time, and they're very important to me, so I needed to say that. I have an older brother who's 2 years older than I am, and I have a sister who's 8 years younger than I am. My mother is still living. She'll be 86 on June the 6th. My dad died 8 years ago, and when he died, they'd been together for 56 years. None of them are alcoholic. They drink. But my family was greatly affected by the disease of alcoholism. My dad's father abandoned his family when my dad was young, and he died on the streets of Knoxville, Tennessee when my dad was a teenager. My mom's dad was an alcoholic, but he was a functioning alcoholic. He went to work every day, and he died when I was a teenager from complications of diabetes. My family has been greatly affected by that, and I understand that today. I didn't know it when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I do have a little better understanding of it today. I drank for the very first time when I was 13 years old, and I planned it. My belly button birthday is May the 30th, so I'll be 61 at the end of this month. But I planned it. A couple of my friends and I always had kind of a spend-the-night party. My birthday always fell after school was over, so I never got to take cupcakes to school or anything like that. And so I had people over, had my friends over from school, had two or three people over just about every year to spend the night, have weekend, play pool, do whatever. And the two people that came to my house that weekend, we planned it. And they stole liquor from their parents, and I stole liquor from my parents. Didn't know what I was stealing, but my parents had a liquor cabinet, and I just stole a little bit, over a period of a couple of weeks. And they did too. And we got drunk, and I got sick. And I made the decision, as I understand it today, that I was going to do that as often as I possibly could from that day forward. And, you know, at 13 years old, it was a little difficult. But I did it every chance I got. Every chance I got. And like I said, my brother is 2 years older than I am, and he's roughly the same height, same back then, same height, same weight. Not exactly, but close. And back then, they didn't have your pictures on your driver's license. And so when I was 17 years old, I was able to go to any convenience store, grocery store, and buy something to drink. And so I drank, you know, like I said, every opportunity I had. And when I knew when I turned 19 years old, I was going to do it as often and as I possibly could. And I did. And I drank just about every day. I gave it up for Lent one time. I was dating a woman, and we decided we'd give it up for Lent. The worst 40 days of my entire life. And I knew when that 40 days was up, I was going to get drunk. I knew it. And I drank for about 3 or 4 days. I really don't remember what happened or anything else, but I knew I was going to do it. About, you know, probably 24 hours into that 40 days, I knew when it was up, I was going to get drunk. And I drank until I was 37 years old. And I drank almost every single day. Not very many days that I didn't drink. I don't know that I got drunk every day, but I drank every day. You know, the last 5 or 6 years of my drinking, I have a job where I get up very early in the morning to go to work, and I get through working about 10:30 or 11 o'clock every day. And I used to go to the same place every day for lunch when I got through working. It was a little barbecue place, and I went there every day, and I was going to have a hamburger, French fries, and Diet Coke every day. And I did it every day. And every day, it was a barbecue shop on one, barbecue place on one side, and a bar on the other. And every day I went in there with the intention of having a hamburger, French fries, and Diet Coke. And every day I went in the room next door and started drinking beer. And I did it every day. The last 5 or 6 years, just about every single day I did it. And I didn't understand why. And I've told this, some people in this room have heard me say it. I used to lay in the bed at night, put my foot on the floor to keep the room from spinning, and swear I wasn't going to do it tomorrow. And I'd stop at that same place the next day, knowing I wasn't going to do it, and then it would happen. And I didn't understand why. Didn't get it. And it was like that, you know, a long, long time. And, you know, and I graduated from high school, and I went to college, and schoolwork kind of got in the way of my drinking, quite honestly. And I learned how to do just enough to get by, and that's all I did, because it just couldn't possibly be more important than my drinking was. I joined a fraternity, like, you know, my dad had done it, my brother had done it, I did it, and I knew I didn't drink like other people. I went to fraternity parties, and we'd have keg parties, and I'd take my own beer. And I know today that most people don't do that. You know, most people don't do that. But I did. I did. And I got reprimanded about the way I acted and all of that. And I didn't really understand any of that then either. And I liked to drink and drive. I liked to go places and drink. And I played, back then, I don't play golf as much as I used to, but I used to play. I bowl every week, and I have done that since college, and play golf, and I was always off on Wednesdays, and so I would go start drinking on Tuesday afternoon and go and bowl on Tuesday night, get up first thing Wednesday morning and go play golf and drink all day and not understand why I felt so horrible the next day. And I did that, and, you know, towards the end of all of that, what happened to me was that paranoia and insomnia ruled my life. I was convinced that the police were following me when I was, you know, I would drink and drive, and I was so concerned about being pulled over and getting a DUI, because I had never, when I walked in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had never been arrested, never got a DUI, never been to treatment. And so, but I was so afraid that that would happen, that I would drive, and I would, at night, I would see the lights in the rearview mirror, and I would pull off on the side of the road and sit and wait, let them get by. And I'd sit there a minute, wait till nobody came, and I'd pull out on the road, and car lights would come up, and I'd pull off. I was telling somebody this the other day, that, you know, the bowling alley is about 15 minutes from my house, and sometimes it'd take me 45 minutes to get home, because I just couldn't, I was so paranoid, and so afraid, and it was consuming me, and the insomnia was incredible, and I sought out a therapist, I went to see him a few times, and I was sitting in front of his desk, and he looked at me, and he finally said, "Hey, man, I'm tired of taking your money." You know, he said, "You don't know how to be honest," and he said, "You drink before you come here," and he said, "You're wasting my time and your money. I don't want it anymore." And he suggested Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was, you know, years before I ever came, and I finally got to a place where I just didn't know what to do, and I went to see my doctor, my family physician, and he gave me an option of, he told me that he would put me in the psych ward at Montclair Hospital, or I could try Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not a fan of hospitals, but I knew what a psych ward was, and I knew there wasn't a handle on the other side of the door. And I was afraid that if I ever got in there, they would never let me out. And so I said, "No, I'll try Alcoholics Anonymous." And so I knew someone who was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to him and told him I wanted to go to an AA meeting. And he said, "Fine." And he said, "Well, I'm going to go on Saturday." And I said, "Well, that's not convenient, you know." He said, "My home group takes a meeting to Montclair Hospital every Monday night. Why don't you go with us?" And I thought, "Yeah, okay, I'll do that." And so he didn't say any more than that. And I met him that Monday night, and we went to Montclair, and they took it into the psych ward. And so I was in a room, and there was three or four of us that went, and then they had all these people from the psych ward that were coming, you know, back then that's where they went, that's where they put alcoholics, they put them in there to detox, and they all came in, they gave us one of the rooms in the psych ward, and they all came in, and, you know, there was a guy on crutches, and there was a guy that looked like he got beat up, and some guy dragging his catheter bag after him, and all of this, and I'm like, "Man, I'm not like these people," you know, and I couldn't hardly wait for it to be over. I thought, you know, "This is crazy. This is not for me. I'm not like these people, you know. No way. You know, I'm not doing this." And the four people, the guy that took me and a couple of other people, you know, we stood outside that hospital and talked for a few minutes. And he convinced me to go to a meeting the next night. And I didn't really want to go, but I did. Because I knew that I was going to have to go back and see my doctor and tell him I tried it. And it just wasn't working for me. So I just thought, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to try it. And I went, and we went to the Mountain Brook meeting in Birmingham, and there's about 150 people, the room was just full of people. Scared me to death. I'm like, "Oh, man, this just ain't for me. I don't know if I can do this. If this is how this is, I just don't know if I can do this." You know, because there wasn't a chance I was going to say anything in front of those people. So when it was over, he said, "Hey, man, you know," he said, "my home group meets on, I'm not going to a meeting tomorrow, you know, Wednesday night, but, you know, my home group meets on Thursday night. Why don't you come there?" So I did. And he went to the Irondale group, and it was a little bitty group. I went there, and, something happened to me that night. I just felt something different than I had the two previous nights. And after the meeting, he stopped me in the kitchen, and we were talking, and, you know, he and I had talked a times, and he was I had really not asked him to be my sponsor, but we kind of had this. He understood what I was trying to ask him. I didn't have the nerve to ask him that, but and he asked me. He said, "Are you willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol?" And I've said, "Well, let me go home and think about it overnight." And he laughed. He laughed. And he still laughs today when I tell that story. So I did, and I talked to him the next day, and I said, "Yeah, you know, I'm willing to do that." And he said, "Well, here's what I want you to do." He said, "We're going to go to some meetings. I want you to go to meetings by yourself, and I want you to call me every day." And he was a college professor, so his schedule was a little different from mine. I used to get up at 2:30 in the morning. You know, he got up at 8:30. The first time, you know, I called him. I don't remember that I called him over that. It seems like we went to a meeting that Saturday morning, and I didn't call him on Sunday. Monday, I called him. He wasn't home. I left a message. Tuesday, I called him. He wasn't home. I left a message. Wednesday, I called him. He answered the phone. He said, "Man, don't ever do that again." He said, "We're going to set up a time for you to call me when I'm going to be here." Because I was calling him when I knew what I realized today, I was calling him at a time when I knew he wouldn't be there, so I wouldn't have to talk to him. And we set up a time for me to call him, and I talked to him every day for over 10 years. Over 10 years, I talked to him every single day, except when he was out of the country. And he was my sponsor for over 20 years. We both decided after about 20 years that our friendship had gotten in the way. Because he is absolutely, I would walk over, if he called me today and asked me to walk over hot coals, I'd do it. He's probably the most important male figure in my life today, other than my sponsor today. He is somebody I love and would do anything for, and he would do anything for me. And we talk, you know, we go to meetings together even today. But we realized that that we needed to do something. We talked about it for months about it, and I just didn't want to do it. I was afraid it would change our relationship, and I did not want to do that. And I talked to his sponsor about it, who is somebody that I think a lot of, who has, you know, over 40 years of sobriety today. And I talked to him about it, and he said, "Mike, you'll know. And I woke up one morning and I knew I needed to make a change. And I called him, and I called Bob, and he said, "Fine." He said, "You know," and so today I have a new sponsor, and his name's David, and he's a terrific. He's about 15 years younger than I am, but he's been sober for 28 years, and he's serious about Alcoholics Anonymous, and he took me through the steps, and he changed my life. He changed my life. It was something I needed to do. We met. We started meeting before COVID, and COVID hit, and I met him at his house every week for months, for about 5 or 6 months probably. We met every Wednesday and went through the steps, and I did an inventory, and it changed my life. We text back. He's of that generation. We text back and forth, and we talk some, but we text. Most of the time, I see him occasionally in meetings, and we're in a book study that six of us started a book study, and we meet every Wednesday, and we're studying the 12 and 12 right now. After the first of the year, I think we're going to do a big Joe and Charlie big book study, the six of us. I came into these rooms and I just didn't really want to do anything. I knew I just didn't want to drink alcohol. But the idea of doing an inventory and being honest with another person, because I realized today I had didn't know how to be honest when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew how to tell you what you wanted to hear, but I didn't know how to be honest because I was afraid. if I told you how I really felt, you might not like me, and so I told you what you wanted to hear. My sponsor, Bob, at the time, you know, he finally said, "Hey, you know, if you don't do an inventory, you're going to get drunk." And he gave me a pad and a pen, and he said, and we met every week, and we met every week so he could see my progress, and we did the columns and all of that, and then we set up a time to get together to do the fifth step. And up until the very moment, I told this story, some people in this room have heard it, that, you know, I'm walking up the steps to his condo praying he wasn't going to be home, because I wasn't sure I could do it. We spent an entire Saturday and half a Sunday going through my fifth step, and I felt as though the weight of the world had been lifted off of me. It forever changed me. Like the book says, I felt a part of Alcoholics Anonymous for the very first time when I did that very first fourth and fifth step. And I've done I did a couple with him. I did one. For me, I was as powerless over my anger as I ever was about alcohol. And anger in sobriety took me to the edge of insanity or death. I wasn't sure that I could ever get over it. And I had people in my life who just simply knew what buttons to push. And I was miserable. The thought of drinking never really occurred to me. But I'm telling you what, packing my shit up in the car and going and leaving sure did. I just wasn't sure I could cope. And I had a friend at the time who was going to my home group, and she worked at a supermarket that I would run into her all the time. And I would see her and I'd say, "Dee, how you doing?" She said, "So far today, I've not contemplated cold-blooded murder." And I thought, I understand that. I get that. That's how I felt sometimes. And Bob said, "Hey, man, we got to do an inventory." And so I did an inventory. On my mother-in-law. She was a person that, what I know today, I saw myself in her. So many things about her that made me so angry were qualities that I had. And I had to do something, or I was going to do something really, really bad. And I knew that was somebody that was going to be, if I was going to stay married to my wife, that was somebody that was going to be involved in my life, and I simply couldn't go on like I was. I had to do something. And the inventory process helped me with that. It helped me to get to a place of understanding and love. If you'd have told me, even before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that someday that I would go to the beach with my mother-in-law and stay a week in the same condominium, I'd say, "You are out of your mind." No way. And I did it. And at the end of her life, I was able to, I grew to a place where I didn't like her very much, but I loved her. And I understand what that means today. And at the end of her life, I was able to be there for her, and for my wife took care of her for 5 years, every day. We even contemplated moving her into our house, and we realized that would be a monumental mistake. Because of this program, we knew it would be a monumental mistake. So my wife went and stayed with her for 5 years, and took care of her, and we finally got her into a home. But it was something that I had to do, because it stifled my recovery. It kept me from seeing the peace and feeling the peace and serenity that I had felt through recovery. And when I came in the rooms, every relationship I had in my family was fractured. I I spoke to my family. I mean, you know, we would go to my family, but it wasn't the kind of relationship that I wanted to have. And through the inventory process, and a lot of time, you know, the book says there's a long period of reconstruction, and you know, those relationships have been you know, fixed. Like I said, my mother's 86 years old, and she lives alone, and I'm able to be there for her today. My dad had died 8 years ago, and he had cancer of the salivary gland. And I was able to, you know, when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, he really wasn't somebody I really needed to have a relationship with. I loved him, but I really didn't have any kind of closeness with him. You know, I was able to take him to treatment, to his chemotherapy and radiation treatments, and we had lunch, and when he died, we were good. We were good. Except for the fact that, you know, my mother, she'd never lived alone. She had married my father fresh out of college. She lived at home in the dorm. Fresh out of college, she married my dad. They'd stayed together for 56 years. She'd never done anything. He did everything. And he had died, and I'm like, oh, shit. She didn't know how to do anything. And I wasn't sure. You know, this program taught me patience and tolerance. You know, I prayed for patience and tolerance, and I got it. And I was able to help her. And today, you know, it's amazing. You know, if I practice these principles in all my affairs, the things that she can do all alone, amazing to me. If you'd have told me my mother would have done some of the things she's done, I'd have said, you're crazy. No way, she can't do it. It's amazing. You know, I had my own business the wholesale food business, and I had my own business for 28 years. And one day, about 7 or 8 years ago, the company that I represented came to Birmingham and said they wanted to have a meeting with me. And so I met them at a hotel and walked into a room with about 8 guys that I didn't know. One guy I knew, the other 7 I didn't know. And they said, hey, we got some changes we're going to make, and we want to make them without you. And I thought somebody kicked me in the throat. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And as I stand here today, it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. But I was pissed. But this program's taught me to do the next right thing. And so that's what I did. And today, you know, I worked, they sold that, they redesigned, they changed everything and sold it to a bunch of different people. And now I work for one of those people, and I love my job every day. It has been quite an experience for me. I came into these rooms, and you know, I sponsor other men, I've told my story a lot of times. But I had every job there was in my home groups. You know, secretary, treasurer, chairperson, all those things. But I'd never gotten involved in service at the intergroup level or the district level before. And somebody I know in this program asked me, our intergroup we have a central office, and we do a thing every year called Picnic in the Park, where we raise money for our central office. And somebody who goes to my home group asked me if I would be involved in that. And so I said, sure. Because what I know is that if I'm asked to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous and I don't have a sufficient reason to say no, then the answer is yes. And that's the way I've always done it. And so I got involved at the intergroup level and the district level, and it changed my recovery. It gave me a side of AA that I didn't really know anything about, and how important that is. Because I love Alcoholics Anonymous, It transformed my life, changed my life. Everything that's good in my life today is a result of coming in here and doing the work. And I'm just learning so much about Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't really ever know before because of the willingness that I had to get involved in that. And today I'm the co-chair of our intergroup committee in Birmingham. And it's been good. COVID happened. I've always gone to a lot of meetings. I've gone to 4 or 5 meetings a week for ever since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to go to meetings. But I do believe that Alcoholics Anonymous, a friend of mine who has about 33 years in recovery, talks about that this is a two-part program. We have the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and we have the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, I got to have both. And I believe that. I got to have both. I got to have the people, but I got to have the program too. I'm somebody who likes to be by himself. I enjoy being by myself. The worst possible thing I could do would be to think I could do this by myself. So I need the people. But COVID hit, meeting stopped, and I'm like, oh no. What am I going to do? Because I was an essential employee, so I was going to have to go to work every day. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And a woman in my home group, she called me and she said, hey, you know, a couple of us are going to get together at a park right down the street. That was March the 19th of last year. She said, we're going to get together at the park. Want to do it? I said, sure. 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I said, sure, be great. We haven't missed a day since that day. We've been meeting every single day at 3 o'clock, and some days we have, and winter, you know, rain, snow, sleet, cold, we've been there every day. And and I've met some incredible people that I would never have met had it not been for that meeting. And it re-energized my recovery. It changed my recovery forever. It's been an incredible experience for me. It got me out of myself, and it enabled me, quite honestly, it gave me the ability to, I realized I was an essential employee, I was going to have to go to work every day. And I was scared, quite honestly, because in my opinion, I'm in the grocery store every day, and it's just a petri dish for COVID, just from my experience. And I was scared. My next door neighbor got COVID in the very beginning of all this, and he died. And he was 47 years old, and he was healthy as a horse and a workout fiend, and he got it, and it ravaged his body. And I was afraid, and I knew that I couldn't do it if I didn't ask God to help me to remove that fear. And as I stand here today, I'm not afraid. And it's been that way for months for me. I just wasn't afraid. I didn't want to get it, but I wasn't afraid. I never could have done that before Alcoholics Anonymous. Never could have done it. Because I didn't come here for a relationship with God. You people probably needed one, but he hadn't done one thing for me when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not one. And I grew up in the Catholic Church, and I blamed what I know today. I blamed God for my alcoholism. And today I know that's not true. But it took me a long time to get to that place. Like I said, that starting that meeting and doing that just rejuvenated my recovery. And then we started back, my early risers home group, we started back last year going to meetings. And last Saturday we had 50 people in person and we had 35 on Zoom. My other group, we started back about 6 weeks ago. So it's getting back to normal, and that's good. I need that. You know, it is just, you know, it's been an incredible journey for me. It's, like I said, it's changed my life. It's done for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know, I just didn't think. I thought I had tried to stop drinking on so many occasions and not been able to do it, but I just simply thought that's how it was going to be. And the desire to drink left me very early on. I don't even recall when it was. And I've only had about 23 and a half years, I've not had a lot of times where I thought about drinking. So it has been, you know, it's been incredible. And one of the things that I love to do is, I'm kind of a speaker taper junkie. When I started, they were tapes. Today, they're CDs. But, you know, my wife and I have had an opportunity to go to a lot of conferences. And I have conference tapes and CDs from every conference I've ever been to. I got a whole bookcase full of CDs because I can't stand to listen to the damn radio. I'm in the car all day. So I listen to speaker tapes a lot. And it's been so good for me to hear that, you know, I'm not alone. I'm not alone. Because I really thought I was when I came here. And you know, I've been a lot of places and gone to a lot of meetings in a lot of places, and it's just amazing to me the miracle of all of this. I do a lot of prayer and meditation has become an important part of my recovery. It wasn't something I fought it in the beginning. Didn't really want to do it. But, you know, today it's really a crucial part of my recovery. Didn't really know that in the beginning, but it's just something that I got to, you know, just have to do. My sponsor used to tell me, do it till it comes a habit, Mike. Do it till it comes a habit. I'm like, okay, you know. And that's what I finally had to do, and it became a habit. It's just something that I do today. I have a lot of different meditation books, and you know, it's just been so incredible, the things that have occurred in my life as a result of coming in here. You know, I've met some great people and have had some incredible experiences. One of the things my home group does, we have a big book study, and so we're reading the book, and I'm going to close with this. My favorite story in the book is Keys to the Kingdom. It's about a woman from Chicago. It's just somebody turned me on to that story many, many years ago, and it's just one of the stories that I like. I enjoy the entertainment section of the book. That's one of the ones that, one of the stories I really like. And at the end, I'm going to read the end of this story. You know, she talks about how the last 15 years of her life have been so rich and meaningful. I have had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that's life. But I also have known a great deal of joy and peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach. That ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle, and a hangover. We have been given the keys to the kingdom. Thanks.